Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. This is Paul Listick from WGN-TV with just an incredible show with some amazing memories coming at you. What you were just listening to, if you sort of couldn't place it, was the theme music for the Hollywood Squares. And there's a reason we're going to be talking about the Hollywood Squares today, because there's a benefit for the Hollywood Museum, all using the Avenue of the Hollywood Squares. But to join me, picture those squares in your head now, folks, because I'm going to bring in three. We're going to fill three of those squares in right now, and we're going to start with, here's a little music for my first guest.
Just put your hand in the hand of the man who found the water. Put your hand in the hand of the man who found the sea.
That the voice, the amazing, buttery, beautiful voice of even as a little kid, I love this guy, and he is with us, John Davidson from The Happiest Millionaire, John, all the way through The Girl with Something Extra. I actually watched that show, and all the other things you do. So good. It's an honor to have you with me. Thanks for joining me.
That's great to be here. It's funny you should play that song, because that's from an old medley that I did way back in the 70s. I did the hits from 1972 or something like that. I used to sing everybody's else's hit record. I never had one of my own.
Well, actually, that was from the medley, and I kind of listened to the whole medley. You had Joy to the World, lots of great songs, but I picked that one because it was so uplifting that I thought, what a great way to start this interview. So, but good memory, because you're absolutely right. It was from that hit from your TV show. And now the next one, I'm going to be a little tricky on this next introduction, because I'm going to play some music that you might not recognize initially. Some of you will and should, but then we'll play some music to let you know exactly who is joining us.
More than you know. More than you know, man of my heart, I love you so. Lately I find you're on my mind more than you know.
Well, you should know that voice. It's such an amazing and beautiful voice. Would be great in a duet with John Davidson, by the way. But if you're not placing it for whatever reason, this will help you place who my next guest is.
Baby, if you've ever wondered whatever became of me, I'm living on the air in Cincinnati, Cincinnati WKRP.
And Lonnie Anderson, from the second I kind of played that theme to remind myself and to put it into cue for today, I can't get it out of my head, including when I'm walking the dogs. I am walking down the street with that damn song in my head, and I thank you for that. Lonnie Anderson.
Well, hello. Oh, what a wonderful song. And I think it takes the place of, like, one of the top 10 themes from television shows from our last decade.
As well,
last century.
And by the way, you know, I played More Than You Know, which is a song that I love, but I mean, I think everybody should know that you also, everybody thinks of you in that role and other movies, which we'll bring up, that you've done, but you're a singer as well. I mean, you've got Grammy Awards behind you, and people should know that voice.
I know it, and what's so interesting about the song you played, More Than You Know, I did it in a film with John Forsyth called Sizzle, and John Forsyth and I were on John Davidson's show being interviewed for that movie, and everybody looked like we were twins. If we had everybody used to tease us about our dimples.
Lonnie, could I have a memory that you were on the pilot, my very first show of Hollywood Squares, when I was the second host Could that have been with Johnny Carson and Dom DeLuise and Burt Reynolds? And weren't you on that show?
Yes, I was. Yeah, we had quite a history.
I wish I could say I planned that little connection, but I didn't. But, boy, I'm glad that worked out. And finally, joining us, look, I know you guys have beautiful voices. I know you're great singers, but I think you have to take kind of a back row to this next voice.
My happiness, because I like the way I am.
Yes, that is the gorgeous voice of Bruce Valance from Hairspray, You Can't Stop the Beat. Bruce, you and I actually met at a piano bar here in Chicago named Gentry's. It was a special night when you were here touring with that show, and you even signed the music to Paul, You're Timeless to Me, which I thought was always great. The great Bruce Valance, thank you for joining us as well.
I've never heard that, a very heard version of it. That's like from a live show. So it's, we used to call that song You Can't Catch Your Breath. Because it goes like, it's like a train, you know, just once you leave the station, it's just, I think I sound a bit rugged there, especially playing a woman, but,
I pulled it from Good Morning America, so you did that live on Good Morning America.
We did it live on Good Morning America.
With the cast. And Bruce,
right before the weather, which was lucky.
Right, before they brought Sam Champion on, we had you. So, Bruce, what people should know about you, of course, is you wrote the Oscars for years. By the way, just quickly, what is your sense of this no-host thing? That puts you out of work with the Oscars, or no?
I think it's I've always thought it was a lousy idea, because you need somebody to guide you through it. And make fun of it as it's happening, and as people are doing stupid things, and it's just to kind of keep it alive and spontaneous. And every time they try it, it's kind of like, it falls flat. But this year was like, you know, crazy, pandemic year, and the whole thing looked like the senior prom. They had decorated the gym. It was a mess.
It should have been the Tonys and a tribute to the prom. By the way, I have to ask you, I can't see you because we're both on the phone, and you can lie to me. What does your T-shirt say? Because every time you appear, you're wearing a T-shirt with an appropriate message. So what does or should your T-shirt say today?
Actually, I'm topless today, which is how people like me.
Ah!
Because this isn't Zoom. If this was Zoom, I'd be fully dressed, you know, or I would stand up and do a Jeffrey Toobin. And we'd really be in trouble. Because this is only, you know, on the air. I don't have to wear any clothing at all. And that, that's what the pandemic has left me. I mean, I've gone back. I'm naked and afraid. Maybe that's what the T-shirt should say, naked and afraid. And then on the bottom, you should be.
By the way, that's why I said you could lie, because you could have given us any answer you wanted. You gave us the truth. John and Lonnie, I will not ask you that same question. But John, let me come back to you.
Lonnie, of course, for the block.
Lonnie for the block? Listen, we are here because there's an amazing event going on. It's streaming, so it works here in Chicago and everywhere. It's a benefit for the Hollywood Museum, which is just an amazing place, all the stuff they have there. And it's five episodes, 30 full-minute episodes of the Hollywood Squares. It's called the Hollywood Museum Squares. I'll tell folks how they can get tickets. 40 classic stars in these episodes. And they've gone back to people who did appear on the show or hosted it. John, let me come to you. You hosted for many years, and you're back into this. Talk about those days of, I mean, singing is what you're known for, but then again, did you like the show host thing? I mean, you had your own sort of, you know, your own Mike Douglas, before Mike Douglas, the Mike Douglas show, that kind of talent. Great stuff in your career.
It was a trick that I had to learn, I must say. I guessed it a lot with Peter Marshall, who, of course, is the award-winning classic host of the Squares. So I would be next to Paul Lynn and, you know, with Wally Cox and Rosemarie and Charlie Weaver and of course, Karen Valentine. But then in 86, my agent called and said, "We've got that series that you've always wanted." I said, "Great, I'm going to be the $6 million man." He said, "No, you're going to host a game show." And believe it or not, I turned it down, which is so silly. I said, "You mean I'm not going to sing on the show? If at least if it's not an action adventure, can I just no, there's no singing. You're just going to host it. And so finally, I took it, and it was probably one of the more fun things that I've done. The beauty of hosting it is, of course, your job is to do what Merv Griffin did, which is to make the stars shine. As the host, you've got to keep throwing it back on those nine incredible people. If you don't like at least one of those, then you haven't been watching film or television. You know? So that's the trick, is to realize that it's not all about you. Tom Bergeron does this so well as well, is that I'm simply a host is to present the stars and to make them come off well, to help them come off well. So I had to learn that as an entertainer. I had to step back and it's not about me. So that was a good lesson.
So, and Lonnie, I'm going to come back to you in a moment, but I want to follow that up with Bruce because of all his work on this show through the years and in Center Square. Bruce, you know, when you listen to this is tic-tac-toe. For people who don't know Hollywood Squares, it's tic-tac-toe. And, of course, whenever they called on, say, Paul Lynde in the past, you knew what a Paul Lynde question was always going to set him up so he could say something essentially dirty and get away with it on television. When Rich Little is on, and Rich Little is part of this special that people can watch for the Hollywood Museum, it always had to involve some star that allowed him to do a voice. So my question is, for you, Bruce, the questions are clearly designed for each star. Do you know about them ahead of time? Could you prepare, or what are you told beforehand?
Yeah, well, I was the head writer on the Whoopi version, the Bergeron version.
Yeah,
we knew the questions, and obviously we got the questions every day from the writer, the other writers, and we had to supply jokes for people. When we knew who was coming on the show, we would craft it for them. Now, we could never tell them the answer, because if it got out that they knew the answers, then the contestants would just agree with them every time, and there would be no show. So we just we would give them something to say, a joke, and we'd give them a bluff. That was the most important thing, something that might be the answer but wasn't the answer. That was what kind of the job was. And, yeah, we crafted it for each person. I mean, the questions were always directed towards people who we thought. My favorite thing was when you ask somebody a question, the audience would start laughing already because they knew that whatever that question was, that person was going to have something funny to say about it. And that was kind of the trick.
Yeah,
I really have my hats off to John, because on this Hollywood Museum Squares, John hosted one and Bergeron hosted one, and Peter was going to host one, but he couldn't do it, so I wound up being the host, which I'd never done, obviously, on television. Although, when they hired Whoopi to be on the show, she said she thought I should host. And they tested me because they didn't want to piss her off so early in the day. So, and there I was, you know, going, this one's for the win, Louise. And they said, well, you know, you're not exactly the type that we had in mind, but we'll put you in a square. And they put me next to her, to the left of Whoopi. And it's very hard to be to the left of Whoopi, trust me.
Yeah, that's very true. No one said that.
So I was a host for one of these Hollywood Museum Squares things, and it's a whole different skill set. I mean, just to keep everything going, to keep the whole thing, the souffle rising, is like you're in a sweat box. I mean, of course, that was the first time I'd done it. John did it 100 million times, so I'm sure it was like, you know, easy for him to, you know, push that button, and he knew what he was up to.
No, it was very hard.
It's not an easy job.
Well, because it was on Zoom, and so you can't. In the live studio, if Bruce is sitting there, I can tell that he's got something funny. You can just see him bubbling and knowing that he could add something to this. And so you go to that. Well, on Zoom and all that, it becomes quite sterile. I'm amazed that the shows look as good as they do, because it was.
I know there's
sterile.
Always that little tiny delay on Zoom.
Yeah,
and these guys who put the show together edited the thing so skillfully that they managed to pull up everything so that it looks like a real show. It's really tight.
It really does. And I talked. And I talked to some of the folks who did the technology. They actually had to develop this technology to make this show work. I'm so glad they did. Lonnie, let me come to you. And, of course, again, the iconic role of Jennifer Marlowe is what you're known by so many for from WKRP. But I have to kind of send you this regard to you. Yesterday, I interviewed a guy named Michael Weber. He's the artistic director for Porchlight Music Theater here in Chicago. When any of you come back to Chicago, you'll be my guest for a show at Porchlight. They do amazing musicals. But as soon as I mentioned that to him, he said, please bring up the Jane Mansfield story with her. He said that was one of the best made for television movies I've ever seen, and she was incredible. And actually, it was sort of that resemblance that let producers want to cast you for the Jennifer role, right? I mean, there is a connection there.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I wasn't totally blonde at the time, and since I was this brunette actress in Minnesota, and then in New York and Chicago, and I was touring in Fiddler on the Roof, and so I was the last person that you would think would be the blonde bombshell anywhere. And it just happened that Hugh Wilson, who created WKRP, wanted somebody to look like Lana Turner and be the smartest person in the room, which, by the way, in 1978 wasn't really popular, wasn't happening. And so that's why it was so groundbreaking. And I always thought I'd go back to my black hair, but no. It got me, and I've been a blonde ever since.
And by the way, what was your role in Fiddler?
Seidel, really? The bride. Yeah,
because you know my
Seidel ever that had a pug.
That was my question. Yeah.
My favorite role of all time is Tev. Yeah, that role is, I think, I'm convinced was written for me. So I really want to recast it with us. You can redo Seidel again. Bruce, you're Laser Wolf. And John, you're Modal, because John has got to be Modal because he's, you know, forever 20 in my head.
Forever.
Well, I'm about to be 80, so you ought to, in December I'll be 80.
No, John, it can't be true.
Yeah, well, let's just say that by now, Modal has really...
Hair.
Let's just say Muddle has really grown his tailoring business into quite the success at this point.
Absolutely. This is George Jefferson. They have a whole separate thing going.
Exactly.
You know, just sitting here listening to Lonnie Anderson, I have never heard her voice without the look, without the incredible looks. Lonnie, I love your voice. Do you do commercial? Do you do
that
voiceovers?
Is so wonderful. And quick, I need a voiceover immediately.
Yeah, really. Well, I don't know where is your voice? Are you an alto or what are you?
What, singing wise?
Well, I don't know how to label it. You're sort
yeah,
of
yeah. Well, I would
into the
where
night
where Anne Murray.
You know,
are you
in
where
all
Anne
my
Murray?
Years of musicals.
Puts her voice?
I'm a belter usually, and so doing that sweet song in Sizzle was a departure for me, and usually I'm the one on stage singing out and hitting the back row.
But I can hear that, but there's a mellowness, there's a femininity, there's a sweetness to it as well. Sweet. You're not just a belter.
I know it, and Bob Hope, whenever I would do his show, we would do a duet, and he always said to me, oh, you sound like Doris Day, and I would think that was the highest compliment I could ever be paid.
And by the way, Lonnie, just last week, Lonnie, my guest on the podcast was Linda Hope, Bob's daughter, talking about life with Bob and his, obviously, you know, all the shows he did and the appearances. And so it's a good chance. Do you want to share any memory with Bob that you have now that we've...
Oh, Bob, oh my gosh, I must have done at least 10 shows, and I was on his very last Christmas special, and I loved working with him. We traveled. He was a mentor. He was... brilliant. You know, when we would make a mistake, so I remember in Bermuda, he kept singing my part in It's a Lovely Day Today, and so, because we had the playback to sing to, and so we got the giggles so badly that they just had to stop and, you know, get everybody to settle down, and we had a live audience, and so while we were stopped, now we've got all these live people in front of us, and Bob immediately went into his act. And had them rolling in the aisles, and I thought, oh, there's a pro. I mean, he just picked
there's
it up.
There's a pro, yep.
I love it. Well, phenomenal. And we talked about his book, Dear Bob, all the letters he got from soldiers in World War II, and he responded to them. It's just an amazing, if you guys haven't seen that book, it's an amazing book written by his daughter and his writer, Martha Bolton. And Bruce, let me come to you. You've written for so many. I mean, the connection between you and Bette Midler, I mean, we can go on and on for all those that you've got, you know, relationships with as a writer. When you hear about Bob Hope, who is your guy? Was there somebody from the past, from the history that you looked at?
I wrote for Bob Hope. I wrote for Bob Hope in the 70s. I was still in Chicago when we met, and Martha actually was also in Chicago. She was a housewife, and she just started writing for him, too. But I came out here to L.A., and I would write for him periodically, and he used to call me Boy Mansfield. And I said, why is that? He said, well, you got the hair and you got the rack. So he would, you know, he would call me and say, Boy Mansfield, let's hope I'm in Jakarta. I need Dewey Sukarno jokes. You know, it was like he put a teletype in my apartment because there was this before faxing and all that. And so he would just, like, in the middle of the night, the thing would start ringing, and he would, you know, from somewhere, I'm in Persia, I need jokes about the Shah. So he was an education to write for. And the best part was, I remember going up to the house once, and there was gas rationing happening. This was in the 70s. Yeah. And so I got to the house, he said, we got to come up with some stuff about this gas rationing. And he took out a little metal file cabinet and opened it up, and there were file cards from World War II. And he had all of his gas rationing jokes, and generally rationing jokes, in this file. And he pulled out these cards, and he goes, yeah, it's a beauty, we can use that. And I said, Bob, you got me competing with writers who've been dead for 30 years. Can I batch this stuff? It's gold. Anyway. Once he said he couldn't see me, I came to the house, and he said, couldn't see me, leave the jokes with the guard. And I said, what, the guard's going to call you up and read you the jokes? I said, no, let me come in and sell them myself. So
I love it.
He changed his mind.
And John, you work with some great comedians as well. I mean, Carol Burnett, working with her show and all of that. Who do you look back on and just go, here, these are some of the greatest I've worked with in all time?
Oh, man. Well, I actually did two of his specials, and then we did a live show in Palm Beach, a fundraiser for them. But I did Roberta with him down at SMU with, I think, Janet Lee was the female in it, and at the Bob Hope Theater at SMU, I think. He did a thing with me, Bruce. It was just a wonderful bit that I'm sure he had done before with whoever, Al Jolson, Eddie Fisher, I don't know. But it's where he stands right behind me, and so I'm right flat. So my butt is in his crotch, you know, okay? So he's standing right behind me, and his arms are underneath my arms, and my arms are, I'm holding my hands together around his back. Can you picture that? So so his arms, it looks as if his arms are my arms. And I'm singing, more than the greatest love the world has known. And his arms are making me look like a woman or trying to undo my belt, like I'm trying to drop my pants. Or, I mean, his arms are picking my nose, you know. So it was a very funny bit. He was very supportive. But the biggest challenge of working with Hope, especially in the sketches on the specials, I'm sure Lonnie remembers this, is that he's reading, he's looking right past your left ear at the cue card.
Always. Yep.
Right. He never looks directly at you because he's got so much dialogue that he has to learn so fast because a lot of the jokes were written an hour before, you know. So he's reading cue cards over your shoulder.
Which, and by the way, Hope was always known for those little side glances, and, you know, we almost took him as looks to the audience, right, where he was connecting with the viewer. Bruce, when you're writing for different people, and not even so much yourself, you have your own style, but how easy is it for you to get into the Bob Hope frame of mind or the Bette Midler frame of mind? I mean, is that an easy thing? You know, there's a show on now called Hacks you probably watched with Gene Smart.
Yes, I have.
I don't know what you think of that, but how easy is it to get into somebody else's head?
You do homework. I mean, you spend a lot of time watching them and listening to them. And if you can't do it now, you can do it electronically. But back when I started, I would actually have to go out to clubs and on the road and stuff like that, and study how people perform, what their style was. And you know, I always I compare it to Bob Mackey, who would not put Cher in the same dress he would put Lizzo. You know, you do your homework. You look and you see what you're working with, and then I'm very lucky in that I hear them and I adapt to who they are. It's a skill, you know. I mean, Aaron Sorkin makes people up out of thin air and makes a lot more money than I do. So maybe I should go into the making characters up business as opposed to writing for other people who exist already.
Or start writing for Martin Sheen.
What I began to realize is that Bob Hope was doing Peck's Bad Boy, basically. And I stole that attitude because I was so clean-cut and so conservative when I first started. And so people didn't expect me to do anything suggestive. But if I did it as Peck's Bad Boy was the phrase we used, and that's what Hope was doing. He was never dirty or foul, but it was this little thing in his eye. Like, oops, did I really say that? Could Bob Hope really say that? So I stole that attitude. I've stolen a lot of things from people.
and Lonnie, when you're in your square here on the virtual Hollywood Squares, Hollywood Museum Squares, I've watched some of the episodes. I need to watch the balance of them. But do they expect you to take on the character of KRP? Do you get to be Lonnie? Who do we get to see?
No, I just get to be Lonnie, which is, you know, that's the fun of the game show, is that you don't have to be your character that everybody is used to. People just get a chance to see you, and hopefully with great Bruce jokes.
And it's so interesting, too, because people, I mean, like, for example, John, I know Paul Lynde, and just watching so many interviews with him, I'm a huge Paul Lynde fan. He was incredibly shy, right? I mean, very different from perhaps the funny man we would see on television all the time.
Well, I guess you could call it shy. I have a whole other side of Paul Lynde that I... Karen Valentine and I really we would sit on either side of him so much, and I saw just a very unhappy, miserable guy who was kind of mad at everybody, including himself. So he was very funny. He did this way of speaking, but you know, he without writers like Bruce, he was a guy who said things in a funny way, but he wasn't like Jonathan Winters or Robin Williams, he wasn't like that. He has a funny actor, and he could often be mean. He could often be mean to people. I saw that other side of him, and it's unfortunate. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
I wrote a couple of television specials for him, and he was on a regular on Donnie and Marie, which I wrote, and we got friendly. And I actually the end of the first iteration of Squares, I was writing for him for Squares back in the late 70s. But he was very, very, very unhappy guy. He was really unhappy, and he drank. And when he drank, he was like the Nazi high command. He was terrifying.
Yeah.
My memories of him are not you know, Sonny and Rosie. Remember Sonny and Rosie? No. They played the part.
They're a great team.
He was mad. I mean, he'd come up on Broadway with a lot of people who became big stars, like Woody Allen and Mel Brooks. But they wrote their own material, and Paul didn't. And he was a flavor. You know, he was something that you injected for one line. He was not the lead of anything, except at Hollywood Squares, where that made him a huge star. And I'm telling you, if he knew that 40 years after his death we were still talking about him, he would be stunned. Because he never felt like he had made it. Because he wasn't doing what he wanted to do.
And that's probably true for a lot of stars who have... Go ahead, John.
I think he was somehow bitter about the fact that Karen Valentine and I were just so wholesome. I mean, we weren't and we aren't, but we both had images of this all-American thing that I think that bugged him, and so he would always try to rip that apart.
And I think he wanted to get to know one of you better.
Well, no, I never felt, you mean, his sexuality? I never...
Yeah, of course.
It wasn't
that was my fiddly veil joke.
Yeah.
Well, as I mean, he would, I would say
terrible things to Karen Valentine about her body in the breaks and stuff. I mean, just awful things that you wouldn't say when you were with a bunch of guys. And it was in order to make her embarrassed and to make her lose this veneer of the wonderful, sweet lady that she is, you know.
The good news is, on the five episodes of the Hollywood Museum squares we're going to see, it is happy and funny and great stories.
The ghost of Paul is not there. What can I tell you?
Right. None of that, but God, I would love to carry on for another hour with you guys, but I'm running out of time, so let me just kind of do a round robin if I can to wrap things up. Lonnie, let me come to you and just say, first of all, and I'll tell people you can get tickets at stellartickets.com, S-T-E-L-L-A-R, tickets.com, and look up Hollywood Museum. Did you have fun doing this? And tell us, what I know you're very involved, you're with your family now and all of that, but what's on your agenda, Lonnie?
Oh, my gosh. Well, now that we've opened back up, we can actually make personal appearances, I think, coming up, guys, and I'm excited about that. And I have a pilot in the works, which, you know, I was in the works before the pandemic started, and then we just had this lull. And so I'm looking forward to that. And I'm just looking forward to getting out and being with wonderful people again and actually seeing you guys in person. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
Well, when you all come back to Chicago, pizza's on me. I can promise you that. John, you know, you sang a little bit during this little interview, and your voice is as beautiful, mellow as ever. Any recording coming up for you?
Well, you're very sweet. My dream has been always to have my own club and to sing in my own place. And I know this is usually a disaster for singers who try to do this, but I live in a town called Sandwich, New Hampshire, and I'm opening a little music venue here called, of course, Club Sandwich.
Did Bruce write that for you?
No. I won't even take credit, but 100% points.
It's called Club Sandwich, and it's right in the middle of Sandwich, and it only holds 35, 40 people. And I'm going to present other singer-songwriters as well. But I sing with my guitar, which is my favorite thing to do at my age. It's the most sensual thing that I do. And I just love singing with my guitar. And, yeah, I think because of my Broadway training, and I think my voice is still pretty good, and I love doing that. So everybody come to Club Sandwich. We open in July.
And may I encourage you, that is kind of a subtitle to Club Sandwich. Underneath it could put Let Us Entertain You. You might want to think about that.
Perfect. You are from Chicago.
Right, exactly. And Mr. Valanche, should I ask when you're coming back to Chicago next? Because you're here. So you started here. You were Chicago Tribune. I mean, I'm calling you a Chicago guy.
I will be there virtually on Monday at 7 o'clock for Porchlight.
Porchlight,
you mentioned earlier. I'm doing a fundraiser for Porchlight Monday night at 7 o'clock. They do a thing called Musical Mondays, which is all virtual, all streamed. And I'm sitting with Rona Friesen, our friend from the library,
yes,
and my old friend from Chicago. And we are, every Monday they discuss a different musical and the movie adaptation. And we're doing Funny Girl on Monday. So Rona, who looks vaguely like Barbara Streisand on a very, very, very good day for Barbara, and I are going to sit down and talk about and kind of dissect the thing and make a lot of jokes about it. So,
I will be
for a paltry sum, you can help support Porchlight, which, as you say, is a great theatrical operation in Chicago.
Indeed, I will actually be in that audience watching that show, and they allowed me to host. It should be no surprise, I hosted Fiddler on the Roof when we ran that movie years ago. By the way, Golda was no fan of Topol, but we'll talk about that on some other show. For now, I want to let everybody know that if you've just enjoyed the fun we've been having, you get more of this fun by watching the Hollywood Museum Squares benefit. It's five shows. Watch them when you want. It's only $10 a show. I don't even know if they told you the tickets are $10. Who cannot do that? You go to stellartickets.com. look for Hollywood Museum. There actually is a direct link to it, but it has so many different symbols and things, I can't say it. So it's five full 30-minute shows, 40 stars. You guys, Kathy Garber, my good friend, I can go on and on. It's such a treat to be watching these things. And I especially, my heart goes out to you three for joining me, giving of your time. I've been a huge fan. I mean, I will tell you, we had 40 people to pick from, and I said, can you get me Bruce, John, and Lonnie? And here you are, and I love you for it, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Oh, hey. Mutual.
We'll talk all soon. Let's all meet for a drink at John's Club for a little sandwich. Thank you, guys. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to having everybody watch on Hollywood Museum Square's benefit. Take care. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye. All right. Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.